It is 1:03. This is House Judiciary. It is Friday, March 13th. With us today are Representative Klayman, Representative Lynn, and I am Chair Ledoux. Please silence your electronic devices. We have two items before us today. First, a presentation by Sam Gottstein on criminal justice matters in rural Alaska. And then secondly, we'll finish with a hearing for Governor Walker's appointee to be successor to the Lieutenant Governor Craig Fleener. So, Mr. Gottstein, could you place yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation?
Sure. Samuel Gottstein. Good afternoon, Chair Ledoux, members of the committee. I'd like to thank you all, especially Chair Ledoux, for inviting me to testify in person this afternoon. As I mentioned, my name is Samuel Gottstein, and I'm in my last semester at Boston College Law School, where I'm on the editorial board of the Boston College Law Review. I'm also an academic law fellow of the Clough Center for the Study of Constitutional Democracy, and I'm here to talk about my recent publication in the Boston College Law Review, which examines Alaska Native tribal jurisdiction and illuminates ways the Alaska State Legislature can and should expand that jurisdiction over certain criminal cases in rural Alaska Native communities.
Thank you, and I'm just going to put you on hold for just a second here just to let the public know that Representative Keller has joined us.
I apologize for being late, Madam Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you. I realize my time is short, so I will do my best to summarize the salient points as quickly and as thoroughly as I can to allow for a little bit of time for questions. On to the second slide. To set the stage, I'd like to highlight some depressing statistics which underscore the importance of this topic. Although Alaska Natives comprise approximately 15% of Alaska's population, Alaska Natives make up 37% of the prison population. 47% of reported rape victims in Alaska are Alaska Native. More than half of women in the Nome census area have experienced intimate partner violence, and that is a conservative estimate. Finally, Alaska Native suicide rates are 400% higher than the national average. What we have here is an epidemic, and as I will discuss further, you have a chance to address this problem. On to the third slide, and before presenting some options to help solve these problems, I'd like to offer a bit of background. American Indian law is known in the legal field for being particularly complicated, and the legal status of Alaska Natives even more so. It is also an area where, if you put two lawyers together in a room, they will have five different opinions, and I say this knowing that there are currently two attorneys on the committee in this room. To start with, Congress has plenary power over the legal status of Alaska Natives. For non-lawyers, this means that Congress has the ultimate say. However, Alaska is a PL 280 state, which means that Congress has also given the state of Alaska criminal jurisdiction over Alaska Native issues, a role otherwise reserved for the federal government. Along with that, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971 is widely viewed as the most important congressional act in Alaska Native law. ANCSA granted Alaska Natives 44 million acres of land and the equivalent of over $5 billion in today's dollars in exchange for extinguishing all other Alaska Native land claims and sovereignty. This was the foundation of the 1998 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Alaska v. Native Village of Venati, where the court unanimously held that there is no Indian country in Alaska. Indeed, in that opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court said that, quote, Congress stated explicitly that ANCSA settlement provisions were intended to avoid a lengthy wardship or trusteeship. However, the very next year, in John v. Baker, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that Alaska Natives still retained the ability to regulate domestic relations among members. This decision, which has been unanimously affirmed, gives Alaska Natives jurisdiction over child custody and family law cases related to their members. That, however, is about as far as Alaska Native tribal jurisdiction goes today. Recent congressional legislation, like the Tribal Law and Order Act of 2010 and the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act of 2013, is in line with the powers provided to Alaska as a PL 280 state. Even though the Alaska exemption to the Violence Against Women Act was recently repealed, because there is no Indian country in Alaska, further state or federal action is still required for that legislation to become a meaningful tool in Alaska for addressing domestic violence and sexual assault. On to the next slide. Slide 4, charged by Congress with assessing American Indian criminal justice systems, the Indian Law and Order Commission published its report in November of 2013 and spent a whole chapter on the status of Alaska Native tribal jurisdiction. I believe that the chair of that commission testified before the legislature last session. That report strongly urges Congress to solve some of the problems with what it sees as Alaska's overly centralized administration of justice. Then, this past December, the Bureau of Indian Affairs added to the mix by adopting a final rule allowing Alaska Native tribes to petition the Secretary of the Interior to put land into trust. This may give Alaska Natives the ability to assert some level of sovereignty, although any laws, regulations, or contracts would be subject to the Secretary's approval. Although it is possible that the federal government could step in to take meaningful action to address this epidemic in rural Alaska, there are two general problems with waiting for the federal government to act. As a practical matter, it is unlikely that Congress will act. In a post-ANCSA world, on the heels of the repeal of Alaska's exemption from the Violence Against Women's Act, I would be surprised if Congress has the will to change the status quo in the near future. Secondly, if the federal government did step in, either through congressional action or through taking lands into trust, those actions would be unappealing to Alaskans. A trust designation or extension of American Indian policy from the lower 48 would not only create a jurisdictional maze that would likely complicate matters, it would fail to tailor a solution to the needs of Alaska and also lack necessary guarantees of constitutional protections for all Alaskans in tribal courts. In short, federal action would be like using a hammer to kill a mosquito. It might get the job done, but in the process, it will likely also cause a great deal of collateral damage. On to slide 5. Rather than wait for the federal government to come up with an imperfect solution, the Alaska State Legislature should act preemptively to grant limited criminal jurisdiction to rural Alaska Native communities to allow them to combat domestic violence, alcohol abuse, and sexual assault. Doing so would not only avoid federal overreach, but would offer a cost-effective way to make rural Alaska Native people and communities safer by more directly involving people who live in those communities. On to slide 6. In addition to increasing public safety in rural Alaska and giving the feds less reason to meddle in our affairs, state legislative action would bring the benefit of preserving the state's sovereignty. The details would naturally need to be worked out. But the legislature could, for example, mandate that an expansion of tribal jurisdiction is subject to legislative approval, which could be revoked or cut back at any time. Under such a scenario, the state would call the shots as to what crimes and who could be prosecuted in Alaska Native tribal courts. To ensure that Alaskans' constitutional rights are protected, the state could require, for example, that all tribal court decisions are appealable to state courts. The state could also dictate exactly where such tribal authority would apply and define the specific geographic scope of each tribal court. Most importantly, this decentralization could be done at minimal cost and lead to substantial additional benefits in the form of lower recidivism rates, decreased court costs, and safer, healthier communities. Next slide. In her State of the Judiciary address this year, Chief Justice Dana Fabe underscored both the importance and the benefits a limited expansion of criminal jurisdiction for tribal courts could bring. Solutions we impose from afar will continue to miss the mark if they fail to take local communities into account. Solutions to the problems of rural Alaska lie in collaborative efforts that bring local people to the table. And as the state system endeavors to do more with less, expanding the role of tribal courts presents an opportunity for significant cost savings. On to the next slide. From an academic perspective, what's most interesting to me is just how ripe this issue is for legislative action. The current administration here in Alaska is actively examining the issue as we speak, and with recent rule changes by the feds, we are presented with an unusual opportunity to help solve a serious, long-standing, systemic public safety problem in rural Alaska Native communities. And again, of crucial importance during this time of tight budgetary constraints, this can all be done while actually saving money. In short, you are presented with a unique opportunity to take action now that will have a real impact on the lives of Alaska Natives at a time when there are life-threatening problems that cry out for meaningful solutions. I strongly believe that expanding limited tribal jurisdiction over selected criminal matters in rural Alaska Native communities is a practical, common-sense idea whose time has come. That concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming here and making that presentation. Representative Lynn, do you have any questions?
Yes, thank you for your presentation. Melitaka, is that a reservation? Melitaka, quote, Indian country?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, yes, Metlakatla is the one exception to the rule, and it is a reservation, and it would be considered Indian country.
So Metlakatla, nothing of this would apply to Metlakatla?
Correct.
Okay. Secondly, what if there's a non-native who commits some kind of crime under this plan here? Would they be subject to tribal law, or only natives?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that would be up for the legislature to decide. For me, it seems like it would make sense for it to apply to non-members, as we like to call it in the legal term, as well as members. And the key under this idea is that the state can ensure that there isn't any funny business, that the constitutional rights of everyone and of all Alaskans are still protected. And that could be done by saying everyone still has a right to an attorney, everyone still abides by U.S. constitutional rights, and if there were some sort of violation, then it could be appealed in state court to make sure that there are no problems.
I think you're anticipating my next question. That these people will be protected under the Constitution of the United States plus the Constitution of Alaska.
Yes.
I may have a couple more questions in a few minutes. Thank you.
Yep.
So when you say, and then I'll get to your question, Representative Keller, when you say that it can be appealed, sometimes things can be appealed and the appeals court doesn't consider facts. And then other times, and it's really where they do consider facts, it's called an appeal, but it actually is another trial. Would you envision it as another trial, or where deference is given to the decision of the tribal court?
To the chair, again, this is something that the legislature would consider and could decide what level of deference to give. To me, what I think makes sense is not to have a de novo trial right away, but not to give that much deference, if that makes sense, to have some sort of less deferential.
I actually think that in the legal parlance there is a middle ground, but I'm not sure about that. Representative Keller, and then Representative Foster, and I announce that Representative Foster, who's going to be answering questions, and Representative Grunberg have now joined us.
Thanks.
And Representative Bryce Edgemond is here in the audience. Would you like to come up and join us too, Representative Edgemond, or at least unless represent? Right now, there's a seat available. If she shows up, we might.
Representative Letterized, I'll surrender my seat.
No, I will. I'll sit back to the audience.
So did you have a question, Representative Keller?
I do.
Okay.
I want to preface the question with the fact that I just want to say philosophically, I always go toward local control, whether we're talking enforcement, judicial, education, whatever. There's an element here of what you bring forward that is very fascinating. But you started by talking about the abysmal suicide and prison and rape rates, you know, amongst Alaska Natives. And it's not clear to me, frankly, and I'll give you a chance to respond, but I want to talk a little bit more about this. It's not clear to me what the link is between tribal sovereignty increase and reduction of the recidivism rate, prison, you know, and the suicide rate and the rape and all that. And I would assume that you have some information that maybe Metlakatla is doing a lot better than others. Our jurisdiction as a whole in the United States of America and by default Alaska, you know, it's based on equality of all human beings, it's based on inherent rights, it's based on natural law. Ultimately, that's the foundation of who we are, what we are. And, you know, the sovereignty of Alaska and the U.S. is we the people, based on we the people. And I just struggle with how tribal sovereignty would improve, how it would collaborate, how it would even maintain necessarily those values under which we all have, which I think are ultimate, by the way, for everybody. It doesn't matter, you know, what tribe, what race, that's all just, so when we start talking about tribal sovereignty, how is that going to maintain those things rather than become a divisive issue? And I'm sure you've given this some thought because I've hit you with this question before.
Yes, through the chair. Representative Keller, you're right. I think it was, I guess to your latter point, it was Governor Hickel, I think, that gave an administrative order saying that Alaska is one nation, one people. And that's certainly the case. And I guess the beauty of this plan is that the state wouldn't give up any sovereignty. It would just be a delegation of some limited criminal jurisdictions with, depending on what the legislature would want to do, with limits as to how far the tribal courts could go. And in terms of the specific the problems in rural Alaska, part of the problem with finding a study that says this is absolutely going to solve all these problems is that the number of times that people have gone to tribal court is so small. I think, for example, in Cake, where they've been doing circle sentencing for 10 years or something, there have been under 50 cases. And so it's really hard in that sense of a very limited minor consuming cases to see exactly, to take that data and then say this is definitely going to be the projection going forward. But I think conceptually I would agree with you that giving more power back to the community to a certain extent would be helpful. And instead of the community saying, oh, well, we can't really do anything about this problem, we'll just have to wait for the VPSO or the troopers to take care of it, it's not our problem because we can't do anything about it, and instead giving the communities the power and the ability to come up with different solutions to try to help solve these problems, given how bad things are in the villages, it's worth a shot. And if nothing else, to have some sort of pilot program even, to see what it would do in some of these communities could make a lot of sense.
Representative Keller.
Just one quick follow-up, and thank you for responding, but I guess I am a little uncomfortable with the idea that this would actually save money. You know, we start talking pilot programs and whatever, and government proposed operations, I just squirm at that because, you know, the things that you suggest, I'm all for, like circle justice, they call it, reform justice. I think those are fantastic ideas, and there are some examples of really successful, but we're told that that's expensive. You know, and if we don't put money in it, it's really those principles are free to be applied in any community in the state of Alaska right now. There's nothing illegal about it. You know, so a community could do this without legislation and changing our structure and that. So I squirm at the idea. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I agree with you in terms of the money aspect. I think I told you that in Arizona, for example, they've got one tribe has a $21 million court facility, and we don't have anything like that here in Alaska for sure. And that is something to consider. In terms of a pilot program, in terms of funding, it could just be some sort of legislation that would just allow for it to happen and allow for these tribal courts to prove that they would be able to take it on, and then we go ahead and see what happens without having to spend it. And in terms of the community, yes, the community can come together and say, come on, like, let's stop having these problems. But on the other side, they wouldn't have the ability, if they were really doing some problems, to say, this is too bad, you got to go to prison, or you have to be incarcerated.
Just one brief.
Thanks.
we don't often deal with laws that make things remind people that this is legal, but we are with the marijuana law, you know, so we're walking through it right now. But it is a very unique approach to.
Representative Foster and then Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate where you're going with this, Mr. Godstein. And I can envision this in places like many of my communities, places like Wales, for example, where there's most people who live there are part of the tribe. How do you envision something like this looking like in a place like Nome or some of the hubs like Kotzebue or Bethel or Barrow, where I think most people who live there probably are not part of the tribe, the local tribe for sure. And then on top of that, you've got a local court there already. And then on top of that, you've got issues of, in Nome, you've got the native nonprofit organization, which is Kuwerik, which represents a lot of, helps to represent a lot of the tribes in the region in terms of a lot of just collectively bringing resources together to administer a lot of different programs. And to me, it seems almost like, you know, they might be the obvious choice in terms of if there was a tribal court that would be a part of their program. But then you've also got the Nome Eskimo community, which is the actual tribe in Nome. So it gets a little bit complicated. I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of how it would look like in a place that's more mixed, like a hub.
Through the chair, Representative Foster. I think in terms of this, it does get a lot more complicated when you have a hub. You know, it's the same reason why some sort of circle sentencing wouldn't really work in Anchorage, for example, because there isn't the same kind of tight-knit community bond between everybody. And so I think as you expand the size of the community, then it does get a little bit harder to have some sort of something like what's existing right now in CAKE. On the flip side, you do have more people, which might be able to have more of a base to actually create more infrastructure. So it's definitely, for something like this, it definitely depends on the various community and would definitely need to be mindful of the different players and the different stakeholders throughout.
Representative Klayman.
I just wanted to check or get kind of a general understanding. Your description is that the kind of joint jurisdiction, if you will, so that somebody could be considered both within existing state courts or either by agreement or by designation to have their case heard in a tribal court or some kind of a tribal entity. Is that kind of what's been going on in CAKE with the circle sentencing? I'm not sure how familiar I am with CAKE, but that was because my general understanding is that cases in CAKE, if all the parties agree, they'll go to circle sentencing, and then the community is much more engaged to some extent in their follow-up and their aftercare, if you will, which may be sort of on the model of therapeutic courts we've been discussing. But are you looking at broader jurisdiction than just what I would describe as voluntary jurisdiction, where the parties agree that this is where they'll go?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. Yes, is the short answer. I am looking at something that's broader than what currently exists. There was a recent rule change for the criminal rules of procedure that give a trial judge discretion to send a case down to a tribal court as long as all the parties agree, the defendant, the prosecution, and the victim, and the tribal court would then have the authority to impose, I think it's a fine of up to $250. So that's what the status quo is now, but it's, as you mentioned, all voluntary. This would change it a little bit and move the needle a little bit more toward allowing more tribal jurisdiction.
And to follow up, so when I hear $250 fine, that in the scheme of things, that's not a lot of authority to impose penalty. Is the idea somewhere of a hybrid between, I know the state has allowed municipalities to take on misdemeanor jurisdiction in certain crimes, but not all crimes, but no felony jurisdiction. Is it kind of a similar idea that the tribal courts would get some lower level jurisdiction, but possibly not as great a jurisdiction, depending upon, I guess, what the legislature decides?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Klayman. Right now it is in the lower level misdemeanor category, right up to a $250 fine. And if the legislature were to act, the legislature could also determine more specifically which crimes it would be. To me, it seems like it would have to start off at a pretty low level with caps. For example, in Indian country in the lower 48, the caps right now are 3 years of incarceration per offense. Is the cap that was recently increased from 1 year just a few years ago. I think that's a good starting point to sort of look at the issue in terms of the maximum penalties.
And I think last
through the
follow-
chair.
Yes, last follow through the chair. How is the tribal circle sentencing experiment in CAKE working out, if you know?
And can you describe circumsentencing?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman and Chair Ledoux. Circle sentencing, from what I'm aware, is you get all of the stakeholders together and interested community members, and they sit around in a circle, and they have one turn to talk each, and they talk through what the problems are with the specific offense. And it's not so much of a focus on this is a bad person. It's more this was something bad that this person did, and we as a community care about you and want you to try to understand that we care about you and that this type of behavior is not okay. In terms of how well it is going, there's, as I've mentioned, very limited data, and it's very hard to draw any conclusions based off of 10 years of data and under 50 cases. What it has shown from the very limited amount is that a year out, recidivism rates are much lower than they would be in the traditional setting. But again, that's not statistically, you can't really pin that and say this is something that says it's definitively the right thing.
A follow-up on that?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then Representative Grunberg.
Oh, no. I was signaling to your partner in crime.
This is an element of circle sentencing that I, from my limited exposure to it, that I'd like to throw out there, is that it gets the victim and the perpetrator together in that circle. So instead of a crime against the state, what gets emphasized is a crime against the person. It's very, very, you know, it's refreshing, and it's also labor intensive, but it's delightful in some ways, and of course impossible in some. If you have a real violent crime, you don't put, you know, the two together. But if you have the significant others from both parties and then work it out, you can see why some of the stuff can. You know, it reduces recidivism because of the fact that, there's a chance to pay your debt, on a very personal basis rather than pay your debt to the state by going to prison. So it's a very intriguing thing, but to me, I love it. But my real question, a point that I maybe, and just to get your response, is I could really get excited if if we could go in the direction of giving court... making borough courts and borough enforcement, borough sheriff, you know, in that element, and it would really do the same thing. It would bring that level of sovereignty and jurisdiction down to the local level, and it removes some of the red flags, I think. To do it. So and just consider that. I mean, if you ever put together a proposed legislation on that, look me up. I really like the idea.
Thank you. Any further questions? We're going to have to start wrapping this up, though, because we've got a confirmation here.
Right. I've just got one last question there.
And then I'll call Representative Grunder.
Probably more.
We're going to do the confirmation first.
No, we're going to do the confirmation after this is finished. That's why we're going to have to begin wrapping this up.
Oh, okay.
Follow up on Representative Keller's comments that two of the sentencing factors that we often reference, I think it's 1255.0005, are community condemnation of the offender and reformation of the offender so that there's less reoffending. And my impression from what I read about the experiment in CAKE has been that it's been successful on both those counts because you're integrating the offender in the community as opposed to sending him to, because CAKE is a Southeast community, instead of sending the person to jail in Juneau for a week,
they actually have to sit down with the people in their community and talk about what happened and talk with the victim and kind of hear this all, and then recognize they have more accountability with other people in the community. And so it's, my general understanding is it's been very successful, at least anecdotally in those areas. Whether it gets to statistically be reliable is the question you raise, and we'll only know if we allow the experiment to go on in more places.
Did you have a question, Representative Bloomberg? Okay, do you want to ask it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was somewhat following along what Representative Klayman said, that when you have the local community involved, as you've talked about, the real thing, it seems to me, that it does is follows the phrase in Article 1, Section 12, concerning community condemnation, and it brings the community more involved and brings the community standards. And it sounds to me from what you've just said, if it whatever the process is, if the result is less recidivism, then maybe by bringing the community more involved, that makes the defendant, it makes the process more meaningful to the defendant. And it may even make it easier to reintegrate the defendant into the community. It looks from the beginning of the process to the final result, which is what's going to happen after the sentence or whatever it is carried out through the chair. Am I right in that?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, yes. There have been some studies about sort of how well the tribal court process has been perceived, and it's pretty clear that again, not necessarily statistically sound, but it appears that there's a strong preference from the community, victims, defendants, everything, that the tribal court process was a better process and that they found that it had more legitimacy to a certain extent because it was from the community.
May I follow through, Madam Chair?
Yes, and then we're going to have to wrap up this line of questioning because we do have this confirmation hearing.
Sure. The sociological makeup of the smaller communities and the Native American communities, rural communities, may vary a lot. So you could have a small community that doesn't have, as Representative Foster said, one particular group, say tribe. And it would be very interesting to me to see how models like this could be carried out in various sizes and sociological mixes to see where it would work and where it wouldn't. Because in Anchorage, you've got a big town, and I don't need an answer now, but it'd be interesting to see where this works and why.
Okay, I've got one question, and then Representative Foster, Representative Edgman, sorry, wants to make a statement, and then we're going to wrap this up unless anybody else has anything that they got to ask. Okay, I generally like the idea of local control. The more local, the better. Where I've kind of got some heartburn, and I've actually talked to Representative Edgman about this. In cases where you're doing a tribal court, but not everybody is a member of that tribe, and they might be belong to no tribe other than the Norwegian tribe or the German tribe, or I mean we're all tribal in a way, or they belong to another smaller tribe. I mean, you might have somebody who's from Southeast living in the Nome area. I mean, that's a different tribe. So my heartburn is that these folks don't get a chance to vote in the local elections. And I mean, we've got kind of a long history of, well, it was no taxation without representation, but it kind of is applicable. So, I mean, how could you make this so that people could vote in certain circumstances in tribal government if they're not part of the tribe? I mean, but they couldn't vote on things like where the tribe is going to spend its money and, you know, financial things like that. But maybe you'd have people voting on criminal stuff. I haven't totally got this clear in my mind what I'm actually thinking, but I want to see if there's something that could be done so that everybody who is going to be under the jurisdiction of this tribal justice has some sort of say or some representation in how it's formed. So I don't know whether that's really a question or it's just a statement, but you can comment on it,
sure,
whatever it is.
To the chair, again, that goes back to the beauty of the state solution, which is that the state can determine who it is that would be subject to the tribal courts and what protections would be in place. And in terms of voting on some of the criminal aspects, I think it's more just a question of when you travel to a jurisdiction, you accept whatever the rules and the laws are of the land there. If I travel to Virginia, I'm subject to the laws of Virginia in that territory. So if the state were to decide to grant it in whatever form that would make, and you can make it in a way so that it's so that you're comfortable with it, of course, then that's what it would be.
But if you travel to Virginia and you stay in Virginia, you can take... You can do a Virginia residency, and you can start voting in Virginia.
Sure. And to the chair, in this case, the state would determine all of the criminal jurisdictional questions. And so as a resident of Alaska, then, in a sense, you have a say in the in your representative, who then has a say in how the laws would work for that case.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity just to say a couple of brief remarks, because I I find this discussion very interesting, having spent a lot of time with the Department of Corrections budget and more recently on a couple of resolutions. First, I appreciate the thoughtful dialogue presentation that Mr. Gosstein is bringing forward. Very respectfully, however, and I hope that this committee gets the opportunity to hear a couple of resolutions that that I'm proposing. But I think we need to take a go-slower approach for a number of reasons. One, there's still outstanding jurisdictional issues. There's issues with authority. The relationships with 100 or so active tribes in the state vary from, you know, one end of the spectrum to the other. But the opportunity, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, is significant. The criminal justice system in Bush, Alaska right now is already way overburdened, and we're at the cusp of cutting back our corrections, our public safety, our courts, our Department of Law, all those agencies are going to be even further stretched. So the opportunity for these smaller communities on a case-by-case basis to come forward with tribal courts at the misdemeanor level primarily, and really allow us to meaningfully get to essentially younger Alaska Native males. If you follow the broken window syndrome, a lot of people that go to jail from the Bush villages end up going in for small and significant items tied to a substance or alcohol, and over a period of events end up being hardcore felons. I would argue, and hopefully I'll get the opportunity to come before this committee and talk more extensively, that there's a better way of doing it. at this point, let's get educated about it. Let's work with various agencies, and let's start building some stronger understanding of what is out there and what legally we can and cannot do at this point.
Thank you, and we look forward to looking at those resolutions. And Mr. Gosstein, thank you so much for coming here and letting us participate in this discussion. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair,
yes.
While we're changing, could I ask Representative Benjamin a question?
No. Mr. Flaner? Okay, the next item on the agenda is the qualifications for Mr. Fleener, who has been appointed by the governor as the lieutenant governor successor. And we will be recommending that his name be referred to the joint body for consideration. I will remind the committee that our job is only to review the history and qualifications of Mr. Fleener. There will be no vote for or against his confirmation in this committee member in this committee today. Committee members should feel free to ask questions as they arise, but bear in mind we are not voting on his qualifications, only reviewing them. Now, Mr. Fleener, please put your name on the record and give us a brief history of your professional qualifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Craig Fleener, and I'm originally from Fort Yukon, although I live in Anchorage now. I've been in Anchorage since 2008. I kind of have two parallel career paths in my life. One is on the military side, and the other is on the civilian side. I've served a total of 27 years in the military. The majority of that, of course, is with the National Guard. I served 4 years in the Marine Corps. I was a 50 caliber machine gunner and also in supply. In the National Guard, I was a KC-135 crew chief and also a maintenance controller. Eventually, I got a commission and became an officer. I started out as a maintenance officer, and I am the chief of wing intelligence now for the 176th Wing out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. And I'm a major in the National Guard. On the civilian side, I've done a little bit of everything, just like every other village boy, I think, growing up in rural Alaska. I've been a diesel mechanic, a janitor. I've swept a lot of floors. I've been a fur buyer, and I worked for my tribal government for about 16 years, doing primarily natural resources stuff. I have a wildlife degree. First degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks is in natural resources management, and my focus has been on wildlife. My focus was primarily on moose management in the interior and with a little bit of endangered species work. I have completed substantial work towards a master's degree at the University of Calgary in Alberta, but I wasn't able to graduate because I was activated by the National Guard a couple of times that interfered with that. I do have a master's degree in international intelligence, and my focus, I just received that degree a couple of years ago, and my focus has been on Arctic sovereignty and our relationship in the Arctic, Alaska's place in the Arctic. Most recently, I worked at the Department of Fish and Game. I was the deputy commissioner. Before then, I was the director of the Division of Subsistence. I served for a while on the Alaska Board of Game. I was also for about 10 years on the Eastern Interior Federal Regional Subsistence Advisory Council. I've served in a wide array of boards and committees throughout my life, just at being part of the normal public service that folks would do. I also served on my tribal council in Fort Yukon and was on the city council for a while. I think those are most of my qualifications, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does anybody have any qualification? Any questions for Mr. Fleener? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe not so much a question, but it sounds like you've got a very, very diverse background, and you said you've done everything from cleaning floors to, a master's in intelligence. And so, rural Alaska, we call that being a Renaissance person, and he can do a little bit of everything. So, just a comment. Thank you.
In rural Alaska, you have to be able to do a little bit
you
of everything.
You have to, exactly.
Representative Clayman.
No. Mr. Fleener, I just want to thank you for coming by this morning and visiting with me some and talking about some of your experience in terms of dealing with Arctic policy as well as some of your experience in the military. And I want to thank you for all your service both to the state and to the country in the military. And I recognize that the position you're being considered for is in one to which you, in the best of all possible worlds, you carry on with your regular job and you're never called on to do anything. But I appreciate your willingness to step up and volunteer for that role in public service.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'm enjoying hearing your report the second time. We had the privilege of listening to you in our State Affairs Committee. You had, I believe you said you're the Gretchen background, is that correct? And you had an opportunity to listen to the first presentation. Do you have any just off-the-cuff comments on what you heard about the first hearing here on tribal courts, et cetera?
Through the chair.
And this has nothing to do with it. Well, it could, I guess, if you were to become Lieutenant Governor.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, actually I've thought about this very thing for a long time, most of my life, because we do have communities that are in peril. And I think one of the big issues around how to help our communities do a better job is we have to localize whatever it's called, whether it's discipline or how these things are handled or meted out. And the further away a person has to go to receive their fine or to when they're being judged by people outside of their community, it almost becomes not being tried by a jury of your peers. If you're going far enough away from your community, you don't have the community looking at you as part of their place, and you end up losing that responsibility to your own community. If it was me and I did something crazy and I had to look across the room at my grandmother, I would be ashamed. And I think that shaming in a community is a powerful thing. So I have always supported, as Chair Ledoux has said, localizing or as close to the individual as possible for justice or many things. And I think we try to do things at too high of a level. So I could probably talk for another hour. I know we don't want to do that, but I have given this a lot of thought. I like the idea of pushing it down to the local level, and I really like the idea of local people holding a local person responsible for their actions and then them paying back in the community, because then it's going to last. If I go to Anchorage, out of Fort Yukon where I come from, if I go to Anchorage, I don't know the people in Anchorage, so I don't feel as if I'm part of that community. If I'm in Fort Yukon and my people are holding me accountable, it's going to last a lot longer.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Bob, because Representative Lynn, because
I'm so
off
about it.
Because I was sitting here thinking, I wonder what Mr. Fleener's opinion is of this, and was thinking about, would it be fair to ask him this question in one of these hearings? So thank you for asking the question. Thank you for your answer to the question. More food for more things to consider. So with that, any other questions? No. For the committee? Is there anybody online who would like to testify with respect to the qualifications of Mr. Fleener or here in this audience? Well, hearing none, then public testimony will now be both opened and closed.
Ross Feelings. This man's over the call.
Thank you. May I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we take the application, Craig Fleener, for Lieutenant Governor's successor, and move it to the full body for their consideration. And as you stated, our action here doesn't reflect how we will vote on the floor.
Thank you. Our next meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will be at 1 o'clock on Monday. Thank you very much, Mr. Fleener. And we're, Mr. Fleener's name is now moved out of committee and advanced to the full House for consideration.
Thank you.